So this deep dive is brought to you by CERT Fuel. They've got a full Series 66 course with adaptive study quizzes, smart flashcards, and unlimited practice exams weighted just like the real thing. Check it out at CertFuel.com.
Highly recommend it, yeah.
Totally. Okay, so to start us off today, I want you to imagine that you are a farmer.
Mm-hmm.
But not just any farmer. You're in 19th century Chicago.
Very specific.
Right. It's early spring, and you have just planted like 10,000 acres of wheat. And you're looking out at all these little green shoots, and you are absolutely terrified.
Sweating bullets.
Exactly. And you're not terrified of locusts or a drought or anything like that.
Yeah.
You are terrified of a massive bumper crop across the entire Midwest.
Because if everyone has an amazing harvest,
the market gets completely flooded with wheat by October, and the price just crashes.
It drops to nothing.
Yeah. And you won't be able to pay off the bank loans for your seed, your tractors, whatever they used back then. You lose the family farm. So what do you do?
I mean, it's a genuine existential crisis for this guy.
It really is. You can't control the weather, right? And you definitely can't control the global supply of grain. But you realize that you can control your financial exposure.
Ah, there it is.
So you get on your horse, you ride into downtown Chicago, and you find a flour miller. And this guy is terrified of the exact opposite scenario.
He's worried about a drought.
Right. He thinks a drought is going to cause wheat prices to skyrocket. So you strike a deal with him. You sign a piece of paper guaranteeing that in October, you will sell him your wheat at a locked-in price of, let's say, $1 per bushel, no matter what the market is doing.
And right there, just in that dusty 19th century transaction, you have essentially invented the modern financial derivative.
Exactly. And that is exactly what we are tearing down today in this deep dive.
Because if you're listening to this right now, it means you're staring down the barrel of the Series 66 exam.
Yeah.
And you've hit the derivative section, specifically futures, forwards, and options.
The big three.
Yeah. And it's the section that makes like incredibly smart professionals question their life choices.
Oh, totally. The textbooks are so dry and the financial jargon feels like it was designed in a lab just to confuse you. And the math can seem entirely counterintuitive.
Which is completely understandable, honestly. The financial industry loves complex terminology. But once you strip away all that jargon, you realize these instruments are really just highly evolved versions of that farmer's handshake deal in Chicago.
Just moving risk around.
Exactly. They are tools designed to transfer risk from someone who doesn't want it to someone who is willing to take it on for a price.
So let's lay out the rules of engagement for our deep dive today. Because we know you are probably tired of standard monotone lectures. Reading definitions like a dictionary is just not going to help you pass this Series 66.
No, you'll zone out in 5 minutes.
Exactly. We know how you learn, so we aren't doing that. We are going to use some truly ridiculous, memorable hypotheticals.
The weirder, the better.
Right. We're going to introduce you to some recurring fictional clients to sort of anchor the math in reality. And we are going to repeat the absolute most crucial concepts until they are permanently glued into your working memory.
And we are going to challenge you too, because active recall is essential for this exam. You can't just passively listen.
Yeah, we are going to ask you direct questions right into your headphones. And we'll actually give you a few seconds of silence to think of the answer before we keep going. So treat this like a real conversation.
Ready when you are.
Awesome. Let's start with the big overarching why. Let's look at the actual word, derivative. What is the core concept we're dealing with here?
So to understand a derivative, you just have to look at the root of the word itself. Derive.
Makes sense.
Right. Mm. A derivative is simply a financial instrument whose value is derived from an underlying asset.
So it doesn't have value on its own.
Nope. The derivative contract itself has absolutely no intrinsic value of its own. It's just a piece of paper. Or, well, more accurately today, a line of code on a server.
Right, yeah.
Its entire existence, its entire price movement, depends completely on what a different real-world asset is doing.
Okay, let's unpack this, because I know the exam tests this foundational concept.
Mm-hmm.
When you say an underlying asset, what are we actually talking about in the real world?
Well, when we talk about options, we're primarily talking about individual stocks, you know, Apple, Microsoft, Tesla.
The big ones.
Yeah. But the underlying asset could be almost anything with a fluctuating price. It could be government treasury bonds. It could be physical commodities like gold, crude oil, or like our farmer, wheat.
Okay.
It could be foreign currencies like the euro or the yen. It can even be something purely mathematical, like the entire S&P 500 stock market index. The derivative is simply a legally binding contract that sits on top of that asset and makes promises based on its price.
So let me make sure I have this crystal clear. If I buy a derivative based on Apple stock, I do not actually own Apple stock.
Correct. You don't own a single share.
I don't get to vote at the shareholder meeting. I don't collect a dividend. I just own a contract that cares very, very deeply about what Apple stock is doing today.
Precisely. You own synthetic exposure. And the reason this matters so much, the reason the Series 66 spends so much time testing you on this, is because as an investment advisor representative, you are going to encounter these tools constantly.
Right, because you'll have high net worth clients holding massive, concentrated stock positions who are terrified of a market crash.
Yeah.
And they need a way to hedge.
Exactly. Or you'll have clients in stagnant markets who desperately want to generate extra yield on their portfolios, or corporate clients who need to lock in the price of raw materials for their manufacturing plants.
And on the flip side of that, you will inevitably have aggressive clients who read something on Reddit and want to use these tools to gamble wildly with massive leverage.
Oh, you will definitely get those clients.
So, as an advisor, you need to know exactly how these tools work, the hidden mathematical risks they carry, and more importantly, when they are disastrously inappropriate for a client's risk profile.
Suitability is everything. Understanding the mechanics is the key to passing the exam, but understanding suitability is the key to protecting your clients.
That is the perfect setup. So, to untangle this whole complex web, we have to start with the foundational piece, the most commonly tested derivative on the Series 66.
Options.
Yes. We are going to spend a massive chunk of our time right now talking about options, the power of choice, and the burden of obligation.
Options are really fascinating because they create a completely asymmetrical relationship between two parties. It's not a balanced deal.
What do you mean by asymmetrical?
Let's define the core concept. At its most basic foundational level, an option is a contract that gives the buyer the right, but entirely not the obligation to buy or sell an underlying asset at a specified price within a strictly specified window of time.
The right, but not the obligation. Let's put that in giant glowing neon letters.
It's the most important phrase.
If I am the buyer of an option, I am holding the remote control. I get to decide if we actually execute this contract or if I just toss it in the trash and walk away.
Exactly. You have all the power.
But every single trade in the financial markets requires two parties.
Right.
There's a buyer and there's a seller. And in the options world, the seller is also known as the writer of the option.
And this brings us to the fundamental power dynamic that dictates everything in the options market. If the buyer pays money to acquire the right to choose, the seller accepts that money and takes on the absolute obligation to perform.
So the seller is trapped.
Basically, yeah. If the buyer presses the button on that remote control and says, "Yes, I am exercising my right, let's do this trade," the seller has absolutely no say in the matter. They must fulfill their end of the bargain, regardless of how much money they are going to lose.
Okay, listener, I told you we were going to ask direct questions. Let's test your active recall right now.
Yeah.
If you just sold an option contract to a stranger on the internet who has the ultimate power to decide what happens next, you or the buyer? I'll give you a beat to think about.
Take a second.
It's the buyer. The seller is completely at their mercy.
And you need to flag this in your notes right now because this is a massive classic exam trap.
Oh, they love this one.
The Series 66 writers love to try and trick you by reversing these roles in a wordy multiple choice question. They'll write a very official sounding convoluted sentence that implies the seller or the writer of the option has the right to exercise the contract.
You need to instantly spot that, cross it out, and reject it. Buyer equals right. Seller or writer equals obligation. That is the bedrock of options theory.
Perfectly said.
Let's bring this out of the abstract and make it real. There are two main flavors of options: calls and puts. We're going to do a deep side-by-side comparison. Let's start with call options. How do they work?
So a call option gives the buyer the right to buy the underlying asset at a specific locked-in price.
I always find it helpful to pull this out of Wall Street and put it on Main Street. Think of a call option like a rain check at a retail electronics store.
Oh, I like this analogy.
Right. Let's say you walk into a big box store and they are having a phenomenal one-day-only sale on a massive high-end 85-inch television. The retail price is normally $2,000, but today they're selling it for $500.
Absolute steal.
It's a steal.
Huh.
But tragedy strikes. You look at the shelf and they are completely sold out.
Classic supply and demand problem.
Right, but the store manager sees you looking devastated. He walks over and says, "Listen, for a small, non-refundable fee of $20, I will write you a customized rain check. When we get a new shipment next month, no matter what the retail price is at that time, you have the absolute right to walk into this store and buy it from me for today's $500 sale price."
Okay, so that $20 fee you just handed him, that is the option premium. You just bought a call option.
Yes. Now, let's analyze the psychology and the math of why you would actually do that. What's your market outlook in this scenario?
You're expecting, or hoping, that when those new TVs finally arrive next month, the retail price is going to be way back up to its normal $2,000.
Right. You are bullish on the price of that TV. You want the price to go up because you hold a magical piece of paper that lets you bypass the market price and buy it at the low locked-in price of $500.
Exactly. Let's play out the winning scenario. A month goes by, the new shipment arrives, you check the store's website, and sure enough, the TVs are selling for $2,000 again.
So you drive down to the store, you slap your rain check on the counter, and you demand your right. You buy a $2,000 television for $500. You are thrilled. You're a happy call option buyer because your bullish prediction came true.
But we need to look at the math of your actual profit here because the exam will ask about this. Your profit isn't $1,500.
Ah, right. Let's do the math out loud. The TV is worth $2,000. I paid $500 to the store to buy it. That's a $1,500 difference. But I also have to subtract the initial cost of the rain check itself, right?
Correct. You paid a $20 premium for the contract. So your net economic benefit is $1,480. The Series 66 expects you to factor in the premium when calculating breaking points and maximum gains.
Okay, so that is the winning scenario. But what if the opposite happens? What if over the next month, the company that manufactures that TV gets involved in a massive scandal? The technology is declared obsolete, and the store is desperately trying to get rid of them for $50 a piece.
Well, in that bearish scenario, your rain check is completely worthless. Why on earth would you walk up to the manager, exercise your right to buy the TV for $500, when you can just walk over to the clearance aisle and buy it off the shelf for $50?
You wouldn't. That would be insane. So you simply tear up the rain check. You allow the contract to expire unexercised.
And what did you actually lose in that worst case scenario?
Just the $20 fee. Mm-hmm. The premium. I didn't lose the $500 because I never bought the TV. My maximum risk, my absolute worst case scenario, was known the very moment I handed over that $20 bill.
Beautiful. Okay, so that is a call option, the right to buy. Now let's pivot to the other flavor, put options. Wow. If a call gives the buyer the right to buy, a put option gives the buyer the right to sell the underlying asset at a specific locked-in price.
The analogy for a put option is an insurance policy. Let's say you just achieved a lifelong dream and you bought a brand new, highly customized sports car for $100,000.
Very nice.
You love this car.
Yeah.
But you're also a realist and you're terrified that you might crash it or that a new model will come out next year and the resale value of your car will just plummet. So you go to a high-end specialty insurance company, you pay them a fee, let's say a $2,000 premium.
And in exchange for that non-refundable $2,000 premium, the insurance underwriter gives you a legally binding contract. It says, for the next 6 months, no matter what happens to this specific car, even if you drive it into a brick wall and it becomes a smoldering, worthless pile of scrap metal, we guarantee that we will step in and buy it from you for exactly $100,000.
That is a put option. I paid a premium to guarantee my right to sell the asset at a locked-in strike price. Now, think about my market outlook as a put buyer. When does my insurance policy become incredibly valuable?
It becomes valuable when disaster strikes. It becomes valuable if the car gets destroyed, if the value of the underlying asset plummets towards zero.
So by definition, put buyers are bearish. They want the price of the underlying asset to fall because they have a locked-in right to sell it at the old high price.
Exactly. Let's do the math on the put option. The car is destroyed. It is worth $0 in the Kelley Blue Book. You call the insurance company and exercise your put option. They hand you a check for $100,000. What is your actual net profit on that options trade?
Well, technically, the gain from the option itself is the $100,000 strike price minus the $2,000 premium I originally paid for the contract. So the net payout from the derivative is $98,000. Okay, before we move forward, let's formally define the critical terminology we've been using because the exam is definitely not going to use the words rain check or insurance fee.
Right. First is the premium. The premium is the price the buyer pays to purchase the option contract in the open market. It's the cost of admission.
And crucially, as we just saw with the $20 TV rain check and the $2,000 car insurance, the premium is the option buyer's absolute maximum possible loss.
Yes. If you buy an option and you are dead wrong about the market direction, you just let the contract expire. You lose the premium and nothing more. The broker doesn't call you demanding more money. The risk is capped.
Awesome. Next is the strike price. Sometimes you'll see it referred to on the exam as the exercise price. This is that locked-in, predetermined price we kept talking about, the $500 TV price, the $100,000 car value.
Right. It is the exact price per share at which the underlying asset will be bought or sold if the buyer decides to exercise the contract.
Then we have the expiration date. Options do not last forever. They aren't like common stock where you can buy shares of Coca-Cola and hold them in your portfolio for 50 years, passing them down to your grandchildren.
No, options have a ticking clock. The expiration date is the absolute last day the option can be exercised. If the market closes on expiration Friday and you haven't used it, it vanishes from your account. It becomes completely worthless.
And finally, the underlying asset. This is the actual financial instrument being controlled by the contract. Standard equity option contracts control exactly 100 shares of the underlying stock.
Yeah.
So if you buy one Apple call option, you're controlling 100 shares of Apple.
Exactly. So we've established the foundational architecture. Calls give you the right to buy, puts give you the right to sell. Buyers pay premiums and hold all the rights. Sellers collect premiums and take on all the obligations.
But what happens when real human beings with real emotions and different risk tolerances start aggressively buying and selling these things in the open market?
This is where the theory becomes practical, and it is a highly testable area. The exam expects you to know exactly what the risk profile, the maximum gain, the maximum loss, and the break-in point looks like for every side of a trade.
To make this stick, I want to introduce you to our first recurring character. Let's call her Cautious Chloe.
I like Chloe.
Chloe's great. She is a highly successful, high net worth technology executive. She has made a lot of money in her career, but she is highly risk averse.
Very protective of her wealth.
Yeah, she has terrible anxiety about waking up and finding out her portfolio has been wiped out by a black swan market event. She wants to participate in the options market. She wants to use leverage to make a profit, but she absolutely refuses to enter any trade where her risk is unknown or unlimited.
Makes sense.
Because of this psychological profile, Cautious Chloe only does one thing in the options market. She only ever BUYS options. She buys long calls and she buys long puts. She's always the owner of the contract.
Let's mathematically examine why Cautious Chloe behaves this way. As we established, option buyers have a mathematically limited maximum loss.
Let me stop you right there. Listener, if you are multitasking right now, if you are driving and looking at the scenery, I need you to mentally pause and focus right now. This specific concept is one of the most frequently tested principles on the entire Series 66 exam.
Truly.
If you are an option buyer, what is your maximum loss? Let's say it together. I'll give you a second to answer. You can never lose more than the premium you paid.
That's it. Let's run the actual numbers for Chloe to prove this. Let's say Chloe is researching a pharmaceutical company. The stock is currently trading at $50 a share. She reads a medical journal and becomes convinced they're going to get FDA approval for a massive new drug next week.
So she is wildly bullish.
Extremely bullish.
Yeah.
So she goes into her brokerage account and buys one call option with a strike price of $50. The market prices that option at a premium of $5 per share. Since a contract is for 100 shares, she pays a total of $500 out of her account.
Okay, what is her maximum risk? It's precisely that $500 total premium. If the FDA rejects the drug and the stock crashes from $50 down to $2 a share, Chloe does not lose $48 a share.
Nope.
She just watches her call option expire worthless. She loses her $500 premium. She sleeps fine that night because she knew her worst case scenario before she clicked the trade button. But let's look at the upside. What is her maximum gain?
Well, for a long call position, the maximum gain is theoretically unlimited. And the exam will use that exact word, unlimited.
Why is it unlimited?
Because historically and mathematically, there is absolutely no ceiling on how high a stock price can go. Infinity is the limit.
Right. If the FDA approves the drug and then a massive tech company decides to acquire the pharma company, that stock could shoot from $50 up to $500 or even $5,000 a share.
It's rare, but it happens.
And cautious Chloe, sitting there with her little contract, still has the absolute right to force the seller to hand over 100 shares for just $50 a share. She makes an absolute fortune. Limited, strictly defined risk, paired with infinite reward potential. That is the magic of buying calls.
Now, what if her analysis points the other way? What if she thinks that $50 pharma company is cooking its books and is about to be investigated by the SEC? She's bearish. She wants to profit from crash.
In that case, she buys a put option. She pays a $5 premium for the right to sell the stock at 50. If the stock goes up to 100 instead, she's wrong.
Yeah.
But again, her maximum loss is perfectly capped at the $5 premium she paid.
But we need to highlight a crucial mathematical nuance here regarding her maximum gain on a put. The exam will definitely test this. For a long put, the maximum gain is not unlimited.
Wait, hold on. Why not? If she's right and the stock crashes, she makes money. Why is it capped?
Because of the floor. A stock price can theoretically rise to infinity, but it cannot fall past zero. A company can go bankrupt, the shares can become worthless, but the stock exchange isn't going to start quoting negative stock prices.
Right.
Therefore, the maximum gain for a put buyer is strictly limited to the strike price minus the premium paid.
I see. Let's do the math. She has the right to sell the stock at $50. The best possible scenario for her is that the stock drops to exactly zero. She buys the worthless stock for 0 pennies in the open market and forces the seller to buy it from her for $50. She makes $50 a share.
Yeah.
But she paid a $5 premium. So her absolute maximum net gain is $45 a share or $4,500 total.
Exactly. It is a massive percentage gain on her $500 investment, but it is a mathematically capped number. It is not unlimited.
Okay, so cautious Chloe loves buying options because the math protects her. She limits her downside to the premium paid. Mm-hmm. But here's the fundamental problem of the market. Every trade requires a counterparty.
Somebody has to take the other side.
If Chloe is buying a call option, someone else out there in the world has to be selling it to her. So allow me to introduce you to the guy on the other side of Chloe's trades. Let's call him Reckless Ricky.
Reckless Ricky operates on a completely different psychological wavelength than Chloe. Ricky looks at the statistics of the options market. He sees that a vast majority of options expire completely worthless and out of the money.
So he thinks buying options is a sucker's game.
Pretty much. Ricky doesn't want to pay premiums. He wants to collect them. He wants to be the casino. He wants to sell the options, collect the cash up front, and rely on the statistical probability that the stock won't move enough to hurt him. So Ricky is an option seller. He is a writer.
And this is where things get incredibly dangerous and where the Series 66 exam is going to heavily scrutinize your understanding. Let's look at an absurd but entirely historically accurate scenario to understand Ricky's risk profile.
Let's hear it.
Let's say Ricky wants some quick cash to fund a vacation. He pulls up his trading platform and looks at a highly volatile, completely ridiculous meme stock. Let's say it's a struggling brick-and-mortar video game retailer currently trading at $10 a share.
Sounds familiar.
Ricky looks at their balance sheet and concludes, this company is destined for bankruptcy. There is absolutely no rational reason the stock should go up.
So Ricky decides to sell a call option on this stock. Specifically, he sells a short call. And because Ricky is aggressive and confident, he does not actually own any underlying shares of the company.
Oh boy.
Yeah. This is what the industry calls an uncovered or naked call.
Ricky finds a buyer, maybe cautious Chloe, on the other side of the country, and sells her the right to buy 100 shares at a strike price of $10. Chloe pays Ricky a $2 premium per share. Ricky instantly sees $200 deposited into his brokerage account.
Free money, right?
He pockets the cash, he goes out to a fancy steak dinner, and he laughs to his friends about how easy it is to print free money in the market. But Ricky forgot about the unpredictable power of retail sentiment and internet forums.
Over the weekend, a massive online community decides they love this video game stock. They realize massive hedge funds have shorted it, and they orchestrate a historic short squeeze. When the market opens on Monday, millions of retail investors start aggressively buying the stock.
And the price doesn't just go up, it goes parabolic. It goes from $10 to $50 to $200 to $500 a share by Wednesday afternoon.
And Ricky suddenly gets a margin alert on his phone. The brokerage firm is notifying him that the buyer of that call option, the person who holds the power, the right, has decided to exercise the contract.
Remember the foundational rule. Ricky is the seller. He holds the obligation.
The contract legally dictates that Ricky must sell 100 shares of this stock to the buyer for $10 a share.
But Ricky sold a naked call. He doesn't own the shares in his account. He has nothing to deliver. So what does the brokerage firm force him to do?
The broker forcefully steps in. They require Ricky to go out into the open market right that second and buy 100 shares at the current astronomical market price of $500 a share.
Oh my God.
Spending $50,000 of his own money just so he can immediately turn around and hand those shares to Chloe for a measly $10 a share.
Let's calculate Ricky's total devastation. He collected $200 in premium at the start. He was forced to buy shares at $500 and sell them at $10, losing $490 per share, or $49,000 total.
His net loss is $48,800.
To make $200, he destroyed his financial life. He loses his savings. He has to liquidate his retirement accounts.
And we use this dramatic, painful example to hammer home one of the most critical gotcha exam traps on the Series 66. We established earlier that a stock price can rise to infinity. Therefore, if you sell a naked call option, your potential risk of loss is theoretically infinite. There is no ceiling.
If you see a multiple choice question that asks, which of the following options positions exposes an investor to unlimited potential risk, you must immediately scan the answers for the short call or the uncovered call.
It is the most dangerous position in standard finance. Sellers have mathematically limited gains. They can only ever keep the premium they collected and massive, potentially unlimited risk. Reckless Ricky indeed.
Okay, we've established the matrix. Let's summarize it so it sticks. Buyers pay premiums for limited risk and large gains. Sellers collect premiums for limited gains and huge, sometimes infinite risk.
That is a perfect summary of the risk profiles.
But wait, if being reckless Ricky is so incredibly dangerous, if you can literally ruin your life for a $200 premium, why does anyone ever use options? Why does this multi-trillion dollar market exist? It's not just a casino for gambling on meme stocks.
Far from it. When used correctly, derivatives are incredibly sophisticated, vital tools for portfolio management. The Series 66 wants you to understand the three primary real-world applications of options: hedging, income generation, and speculation.
Let's dive into hedging first, and let's bring cautious Chloe back into the picture. We know Chloe buys options, but let's give her a broader portfolio. Chloe has worked for a major, publicly traded tech giant for 20 years. A huge portion of her compensation was in company stock.
She's loaded up.
She now owns 100,000 shares. It represents 80% of her total net worth. It is her entire retirement plan.
And Chloe has a serious problem. The broader economic indicators are flashing red. Inflation is up, interest rates are rising, and there are credible rumors of an impending severe recession. Chloe is terrified that the tech sector is going to crash right before she retires.
So what can she do? A novice might say, just sell the stock. But Chloe has a low-cost basis. If she sells 100,000 shares, she'll trigger a multi-million dollar capital gains tax bill that will devastate her wealth.
She doesn't want to sell. She just wants protection. She wants to build a moat around her castle.
This is the absolute perfect textbook scenario for a strategy called a protective put. Chloe goes into the options market and buys put options on her own tech company stock.
Remember our analogy from earlier. Buying a put is exactly like buying car insurance. But in this case, the sequence of events is different. She is buying the insurance policy after she already owns the car.
Right. She already has the massive stock portfolio sitting in her account. Now she's paying a premium out of pocket to guarantee she has the absolute right to sell that stock at a locked-in strike price, let's say just 10% below current market value.
Let's trace the mechanics of how this hedge actually functions. Assume the worst happens. The recession hits and her tech stock plummets by 50%. If she didn't have the hedge, her net worth would be cut in half. She would be panicking.
But Chloe doesn't panic, because as the stock price crashes, the value of her put option mathematically explodes. Remember, put buyers are bearish and their contracts gain intrinsic value as the stock falls.
The massive profits she makes on the put option contracts offset the massive paper losses in her stock portfolio. She effectively transferred the systemic risk of a market crash off of her own shoulders and onto the shoulders of the person who sold her the put.
The Series 66 exam will relentlessly test this concept of risk transfer and downside protection. If a question asks for the best strategy to protect a long stock position against a market decline, the answer is buying a put. Hedging is about using a derivative to neutralize the risk of an existing asset.
All right, that's hedging. downside protection. Now, what about the second application, income generation?
Let's go back and talk to Reckless Ricky. After the meme stock disaster, Ricky was humbled. He realized naked calls are financial suicide. But Ricky still loves the idea of generating passive income. He still wants to be the casino, sell options, and collect those premium checks.
He just wants to do it without risking unlimited loss. He wants to sell a call, but he wants to sleep at night. He wants safety.
Direct question to you, the listener. Pause and think about this. If Ricky wants to sell a call option to collect a premium, but he absolutely refuses to take on the unlimited risk of a naked short squeeze, what must he do first before he sells a contract? I'll give you a beat.
It's the only way to be safe.
He needs to already own the underlying stock.
Precisely. And this leads us to one of the most frequently tested conservative option strategies in the industry, the covered call.
The word covered is completely literal here. It means your massive infinite upside risk is physically covered because you already have the shares sitting in your account ready to deliver.
Let's walk through a covered call scenario. Let's say Ricky owns 1,000 shares of a very stable, boring, blue chip utility company. It pays a nice 3% dividend, but the stock price moves like molasses. It just sits at $50 a share year after year.
Ricky looks at his portfolio and thinks a 3% dividend is fine, but I want to squeeze more yield out of this stagnant asset. So he looks at the options chain. He sees he can sell call options with a strike price of $55, expiring in 2 months. The market is willing to pay him a $2 premium per share for those calls.
Ricky sells 10 contracts covering his 1,000 shares and instantly collects $2,000 in premium. That cash is his to keep forever.
Now, let's look at the two possible outcomes. Scenario one, the utility stock does what it always does. It just sits there at $50. The 2 months pass. The call options expire completely out of the money and worthless.
In that scenario, Ricky achieves his exact goal. He keeps his 1,000 shares of the utility company, he continues to collect his quarterly dividends, and he gets to keep the $2,000 in premium he collected.
He generated synthetic income on a stagnant asset. He can repeat this process every 2 months, constantly skimming premiums off the market, free money.
But let's look at scenario two. What if the utility company suddenly announces they invented a revolutionary new power grid technology? The stock price shocks everyone and shoots up to $70 a share.
Remember the rules. Ricky sold a call. He has the obligation. The buyer of that call is going to look at the $70 stock, smile, and exercise their right to buy it for the $55 strike price. Ricky is legally obligated to sell.
But notice the crucial life-saving difference between this and the naked meme stock trade. Ricky does not have to panic. He doesn't have to go into the open market and buy shares for $70.
He simply takes the 1,000 shares he already owns, the ones sitting right there in his brokerage account, and hands them over to the buyer for $55.
Now, let's analyze Ricky's emotions and his math here. Did he lose money? No. He bought the stock at 50. He was forced to sell it at 55. So he made a $5 per share capital gain. Plus, he gets to keep the $2 premium. His total profit is $7 a share.
So why might he be upset? He's upset because the stock is trading at 70. He missed out on $15 per share of upside profit because he capped his gains at the $55 strike price.
And that is the fundamental trade-off of the covered call strategy. And it's exactly how it will be tested on the exam. A covered call writer generates immediate premium income and gains a tiny bit of downside protection equal to the premium received. But in exchange, they strictly limit their maximum potential upside profit.
You're trading future potential for guaranteed cash today. It's considered a conservative income-generating strategy suitable for moderately bullish or neutral investors.
Beautifully explained. And finally, the third use case for options is speculation. This is what we see all over financial news and internet forums. This is where you use options purely to profit from anticipated price movements, but you use the derivative structure to achieve massive leverage with a very small capital outlay.
Leverage is the key word here. Options allow you to control a vast amount of underlying equity for pennies on the dollar.
Let's run a quick speculative leverage example. Let's say I am absolutely convinced that a massive artificial intelligence company is going to announce an earth-shattering earnings report next week. The stock is currently trading at $500 a share.
I am highly convicted, and I want to buy 100 shares to ride the wave. But there's a problem. I don't have $50,000 sitting in my checking account. I only have $2,000 to invest.
So instead of buying a measly 4 shares of the actual stock, you turn to the options market. You take your $2,000 and you buy call options that expire in 2 weeks. Because options are priced at a fraction of the underlying asset, your $2,000 might be enough to buy contracts that control 100 or even 200 full shares of the AI stock.
You see the leverage there? I'm using a tiny amount of money to control a massive notional value of stock. If my speculation is correct, and the earnings report is incredible, and the stock jumped 20% to $600, the value of my call options won't just go up 20%.
They will explode.
Because of leverage, my options might jump 200 or 300% in value. I turn my $2,000 into $6,000 overnight.
That is the allure of speculation, but the exam demands you understand the flip side. What happens if you are wrong?
If the earnings report is a dud, the stock drops 10%. If I bought the shares, I'd just be down 10%. I could hold them and wait for a recovery. But because I bought short-term options, the intrinsic value evaporates. The expiration clock runs out.
The options expire worthless and you lose 100% of your $2,000 investment.
A 10% drop in the stock caused a total 100% wipeout of my capital. Speculation with options offers asymmetrical upside, but it carries an incredibly high probability of total capital loss.
And that perfectly encapsulates the three pillars of options: hedging for protection, covered calls for income, and leveraged speculation for aggressive growth.
All right, listener, take a deep breath, roll your shoulders, and shake it out. We have conquered the foundational mechanics of options. We understand the power of choice, the burden of obligation, and the specific math of premiums and strikes. But now we're going to shift gears entirely.
We are moving to a different neighborhood in the derivatives market.
Exactly. Options are fantastic because of their flexibility. Having the right to walk away is a great feature for an investor. But let's step away from Wall Street and think about the actual physical global economy, the supply chains that feed cities and power factories.
You cannot run a global supply chain on maybes.
What if a massive multinational bread company needs an absolute ironclad, guaranteed delivery of wheat next November to keep their bakeries running? They don't want the option to buy wheat. They need a definitive contract.
We are leaving the flexible, asymmetric world of options, and we're entering the rigid, binding, high-stakes world of futures, where options are a handshake and a rain check, futures are handcuffs.
That analogy is spot on. Options are characterized by choice for the buyer. Futures are defined by mutual, inescapable obligation. Let's establish the formal definition.
A futures contract is a legally binding agreement between two parties to buy or sell a specified quantity of a specific underlying asset at a predetermined price on a specific standardized future date.
Wait, let me push back on this to make sure the distinction is completely clear. So if I buy a futures contract for crude oil, there is no right to walk away if the price of oil crashes. I don't get to just lose a small premium and tear up the contract. I am legally locked in.
You are completely locked in. And equally important, the seller on the other side of that trade is completely locked in. Unlike options, where the power dynamic is lopsided, a futures contract is a symmetrical, legally binding commitment for both parties.
Both of them.
The buyer must buy the asset and pay the agreed upon price, and the seller must deliver the asset. There is absolutely no optionality.
Listener, grab your highlighter. This is a gigantic exam trap. The Series 66 test writers will actively try to confuse your options knowledge with your futures knowledge.
They do it all the time.
They will ask a question about who holds the obligation in a futures contract. If you rush, you might rely on your options memory and say only the seller. You will get the question wrong. In a futures contract, the answer is always both parties. Everyone is obligated. Mutual handcuffs.
To really understand why this strict mutual obligation is necessary for the economy, we need to bring in our next character. Let's talk about Farmer Fred.
I love Farmer Fred.
Yeah.
Fred is not a guy with a backyard garden. Fred is the CEO of a massive institutional-scale agricultural operation. He farms tens of thousands of acres of industrial-grade wheat that is used to supply commercial bakeries nationwide. It's March. Fred is preparing to plant.
He looks at his projections, and he knows with near certainty that in September, he is going to have 100,000 bushels of wheat to sell.
But Fred faces massive, unhedgeable systemic risk. He doesn't know what the market price of wheat will be in September.
Right. If the weather is perfect globally, the market will be flooded and the price per bushel will collapse. If wheat drops from $8 a bushel to $4, Fred's profit margins are wiped out.
He won't be able to pay the massive loans he took out for his John Deere combines. He could lose the entire operation. Fred is paralyzed by price volatility.
So Fred needs economic certainty. He goes to the futures market. Specifically, he connects to a regulated, centralized exchange, like the CME Group, the Chicago Mercantile Exchange, and Fred sells wheat futures.
He enters into a binding, standardized contract that dictates, in exactly 6 months, in September, I will deliver 100,000 bushels of number two soft red winter wheat, and the buyer will pay me exactly $8 per bushel.
He locked in his selling price. He doesn't care if the global price of wheat drops to a penny. He is legally guaranteed $8. Now look at the other side of the trade. Who is buying that contract?
It might be a massive global cereal corporation. They have the exact opposite nightmare. They're terrified that a drought in Europe will ruin the global crop and the price of wheat will double to $16 a bushel, completely destroying their profit margins on cereal.
So the cereal company BUYS the futures contract from Fred. They lock in the mutual obligation to buy that exact quantity of wheat at $8 a bushel.
This is the underlying genius of the futures market. It is a highly efficient, regulated machine for transferring risk between commercial participants. Farmer Fred completely eliminated his risk of falling prices. The cereal company completely eliminated their risk of rising prices. They both achieved absolute business certainty.
And while agricultural commodities like Fred's wheat or crude oil, gold, and natural gas are the historical roots of the futures market, the Series 66 wants you to know that the underlying assets have expanded massively.
Oh, for sure.
Today, the highest volume futures contracts are based on financial instruments. You can trade futures on U.S. Treasury bonds to hedge against interest rate changes. You can trade futures on stock indexes like the S&P 500 or the NASDAQ. You can even trade currency futures on the euro or the British pound.
Okay, so the concept makes sense. They locked in a deal for 6 months from now. But let's look at human nature. How does the exchange actually ensure that nobody backs out? 6 months is a long time.
It is a long time.
What if there is a massive drought and the open market price of wheat skyrockets to $20 a bushel? Farmer Fred is going to be sitting on his tractor looking at his contracts for $8, and he is going to be incredibly tempted to break the law, tear up the paperwork, and just sell his wheat on the open cash market for 20 bucks to make a fortune. How does the financial system prevent him from defaulting?
The system prevents default through a highly sophisticated two-part financial mechanism that is utterly unique to the futures market, and both parts are heavily tested on the exam. The first mechanism is called margin.
SDOP. Pattern interrupt. Let's halt the conversation cold right here. I need to clarify a massive point of confusion because the terminology here is treacherous.
Go for it.
When I am studying for the Series 7 or the Series 66, and I hear the word margin in the context of a normal stock brokerage account, it means I am utilizing Regulation T to borrow money from my broker, right? Like taking out a margin loan to buy more shares of Apple, and I have to pay interest on that borrowed money. Mm-hmm. Is that what margin means in the futures market?
And no. And I'm incredibly glad you stopped us because this is the gotcha exam trap of all gotcha exam traps. It catches thousands of test takers every year. Futures margin is absolutely, unequivocally not a loan. You are not borrowing a single dime of money from your broker to buy a futures contract.
Wait, if I'm not borrowing money, then what the heck is futures margin? Why do they use the same word?
It is a terrible quirk of financial vocabulary.
Yeah.
Futures margin is best understood as a good faith performance bond or a security deposit.
Oh, like when you rent a new apartment, you give the landlord a security deposit. The landlord doesn't keep the money, and you aren't taking out a loan from the landlord. You're just parking a chunk of your own cash in an escrow account to prove that you are serious, that you have skin in the game, and that you have the financial capacity to cover any damages if you trash the apartment.
That is the exact perfect analogy. Because a futures contract is an agreement to do something months in the future, the exchange requires both the buyer and the seller to deposit this initial margin. You are parking cash with the clearinghouse to prove you will honor the contract. If you behave and fulfill your obligation at expiration, you get your margin deposit back in full.
I love that. Futures margin is a performance deposit, not a loan. Listener, tattoo that on the inside of your eyelids for test day. You do not pay interest on futures margin because you haven't borrowed anything.
Never.
Okay, so Fred deposits $50,000 of cash. The cereal company deposits $50,000. The exchange holds it as a security deposit to make sure everyone behaves. What is the second mechanism to prevent default?
The second mechanism is called mark-to-market, also known as daily settlement. This is arguably the most defining structural feature of a futures contract, and it is how the exchange ensures that massive losses don't silently accumulate behind the scenes.
Let's bring Reckless Ricky back into the story to explain this, because it involves rapid-fire math. Ricky got bored of the options market and decided he wanted to trade highly leveraged S&P 500 futures contracts. He thinks the stock market is going to rally, so he buys one S&P 500 futures contract.
The broker requires him to deposit $10,000 of his own cash as initial margin, his good faith deposit.
Here is how mark-to-market actually works in practice. The futures exchange does not wait until the expiration date, 3 months from now, to see who won and who lost. They settle the score every single day.
At the end of every single trading session, usually around 4.15 p.m. Eastern, the exchange looks at the final closing price of the futures contract. They then mathematically calculate the daily gains and losses for every single participant in the market.
It is a daily reckoning. Let's say it was a great day for the market. The S&P 500 rallied hard. Ricky's position gained $1,000 in value. The exchange clearinghouse literally reaches into the account of the person who sold Ricky that contract, debits $1,000 from their security deposit, and credits that cash directly into Ricky's margin account.
Ricky's balance goes from $10,000 up to $11,000. He can physically withdraw that $1,000 if he wants to.
But the sword cuts both ways. What if the market has a terrible day? What if the S&P 500 tanks and Ricky's position loses $2,000?
The clearinghouse doesn't care about Ricky's feelings. At 4:15 p.m., they instantly debit $2,000 from Ricky's account and hand it to the seller. Ricky's balance is instantly reduced to $8,000. The money is gone, settled, done. The slate is wiped clean for the next day.
And this daily mark-to-market process prevents the exact scenario we were worried about with Farmer Fred defaulting. Because gains and losses are realized and moved every single afternoon, a trader can never build up a massive, insurmountable debt over 6 months. The exchange is constantly truing up the accounts.
But wait, let's follow the math. What happens if Ricky hits a really bad streak? What if the market drops for 5 consecutive days and his account balance is being drained by $1,000 every single afternoon? He started with a $10,000 initial margin deposit. Now his balance is down to $5,000.
This introduces the concept of maintenance margin. The exchange sets a floor. Let's say the maintenance margin is $8,000. If Ricky's account drops below that specific threshold, he triggers a margin call.
This is the dreaded phone call. The broker contacts Ricky and says, "Ricky, your security deposit has been severely depleted by your trading losses. You must wire us fresh cash immediately to bring your account back up."
And here is a crucial nuance for the exam. When Ricky gets a margin call, he doesn't just deposit enough money to get back to the maintenance level. He must deposit enough funds to bring his account all the way back up to the original initial margin requirement of $10,000.
So if he is at $5,000, he has to wire $5,000 by the next morning. What if Ricky says, "Hey man, my bank account is empty, just give me a few days, let it ride, I swear the market is going to bounce back next week."
The broker will say no. The futures market does not run on hopes, dreams, or IOUs. If Ricky cannot immediately produce the cash to meet the margin call, the broker will unilaterally step in and liquidate his position.
They will execute a market order to close out his trade, lock in his losses, and protect the clearinghouse from any further risk. You pay up every day or you get forcefully kicked out of the casino.
Okay, that makes total sense. So that is the structure of futures. They trade on regulated exchanges like the CME. They are standardized. They require a performance deposit, and they settle daily through mark-to-market accounting. The clearinghouse acts as the ultimate middleman, guaranteeing every trade. But let's look at a different, highly specialized scenario. Let's go back to Farmer Fred in Chicago.
What is Fred's new problem?
Well, what if Fred realizes that Standard Industrial Wheat isn't profitable anymore? What if Fred decides to pivot his entire operation and he becomes a mad scientist of agriculture? He spends years developing a highly specific, genetically unique, mutant strain of organic, gluten-free purple wheat.
Interesting pivot.
And it turns out there is exactly one buyer for this wheat. A massive, ultra-high-end, artisanal bakery chain based in Brooklyn.
In that specific scenario, Fred can no longer use the CME group to hedge his risk.
Why not?
Because regulated futures exchanges only deal in highly standardized, completely commoditized contracts. The exchange dictates the exact grade, the exact quantity, and the exact delivery dates. They have a highly liquid contract for number 2 soft red winter wheat. They absolutely do not have a contract for Fred's mutant organic purple wheat.
They're not set up for that.
Exactly. The exchange is a wholesale warehouse. They do not process custom bespoke orders.
So Fred has a massive problem. He still needs to lock in a price for his harvest next season, but he is locked out of the regulated futures exchange. He needs a custom negotiated deal. he needs to leave the well-lit, highly regulated safety of the futures market and enter the dark, unregulated wild west of derivatives. He needs a forward contract.
That is exactly right. A forward contract is the predecessor to the futures contract. It is a private bespoke agreement negotiated directly between two parties to buy or sell a specific asset at a specified price on a specific future date. Crucially, it operates completely over-the-counter or OTC.
Over-the-counter. Let's translate that piece of jargon. When I hear OTC in this context, I want you to imagine a handshake deal. The regulated futures market is like buying concert tickets through a major regulated platform like Ticketmaster. You know the tickets are standardized, you know the platform is secure, and if the concert is canceled, the clearinghouse refunds your money.
It's safe.
But a forward contract is like going on Craigslist, finding a guy named Snake, meeting him in a diner parking lot, and handing him an envelope of cash for paper tickets. You are getting exactly what you asked for, a custom transaction, but you are entirely relying on the honor system that Snake isn't going to rip you off.
That is a very vivid, if slightly terrifying, analogy. Let's do a direct side-by-side comparison of futures versus forwards, because the Series 66 exam will test you on these differences relentlessly. They love to mix up the characteristics of these two instruments.
Rapid-fire comparison time. Let's bounce these concepts back and forth to lock them in. Let's start with venue. Where do these derivatives actually trade?
Futures trade exclusively on a regulated, centralized exchange, like the Chicago Mercantile Exchange or the Intercontinental Exchange. Forwards trade entirely over-the-counter OTC, directly between banks, corporations, or individuals. And here is an actionable exam tip. If a test question mentions a derivative that trades OTC or is part of the OTC market, they are almost always signaling that the answer is a forward contract.
Okay. Regulated versus OTC. Next up, standardization. How strict are the terms?
Futures are completely standardized. The exchange rigidly dictates the exact size of the contract, for example. Exactly 1,000 barrels of oil, the acceptable quality grades, and the specific delivery months. You cannot negotiate terms. You take it or leave it.
But forwards are different.
Forwards, on the other hand, are entirely customizable. Fred in the Brooklyn Bakery can sit in a room and negotiate the exact poundage of purple wheat, the specific moisture content required, and mandate delivery to a specific loading dock in Brooklyn on a Tuesday afternoon. It is infinitely flexible.
Okay, next category, settlement. When does the actual money change hands?
We just spent a lot of time discussing this for futures. Futures utilize daily settlement. They are marked to market every single afternoon with gains and losses instantly credited and debited.
And forward.
Forward contracts, however, are fundamentally different. They are settled at expiration only. If Fred signs a 6-month forward contract with the bakery, absolutely no money changes hands for 6 months. There is no daily mark to market. They just wait until the final delivery day in September and they settle the entire massive transaction all at once.
Next, liquidity. What happens if I change my mind? What if I want to back out of the deal halfway through?
Futures have incredibly high liquidity. If Ricky wants to close out his S&P 500 futures contract after 3 days, he just opens his brokerage app, clicks sell to close, and dumps the contract onto the exchange where thousands of algorithmic traders are waiting to buy it. It takes milliseconds. You can exit a futures contract instantly. Forwards have effectively zero liquidity. They are highly illiquid. If Fred decides 3 months in that he wants to back out of the purple wheat deal, he can't just sell the contract to a stranger. No stranger wants mutant wheat. He has to go back to the exact same bakery executive in Brooklyn and beg to renegotiate the deal to get out of it.
And finally, the biggest difference of all, the ultimate exam trap regarding derivatives. Let's talk about risk.
In the regulated futures market, you are protected by the clearinghouse. The exchange acts as the ultimate middleman, becoming the buyer to every seller and the seller to every buyer. They mathematically guarantee the trade.
So if a company fails?
If the massive cereal company goes bankrupt in July, the CME clearinghouse steps in, uses its massive reserve funds, and pays Farmer Fred his $8 a bushel. The risk of the other person defaulting is virtually eliminated.
But in the forward market, with the handshake deal?
In the OTC forward market, there is no clearinghouse. There is no middleman. There is no safety net. It is just Fred and the bakery. If the bakery expands too fast and files for bankruptcy 3 months into the contract, Fred is completely out of luck.
He's just stuck.
He has a legally binding piece of paper, but he is holding a contract with a ghost. He won't get paid. This specific vulnerability is called counterparty risk.
Counterparty risk. Listener, I want you to highlight it, circle it, draw a star next to it. If a Series 66 question asks, which of the following derivatives exposes an investor to the highest degree of counterparty risk? The answer is always, always, always forward contracts.
Without fail.
Because there is no bouncer at the door. There is no exchange guarantee. You are entirely 100% dependent on the financial health and integrity of the specific guy sitting across the table from you.
Excellent summary. So we have exhaustively covered the plumbing and the mechanics of options, futures, and forwards. But the Series 66 exam is a professional licensing exam. They are not just going to test your ability to memorize vocabulary words like a parrot.
They want to know if you understand the conceptual trade-offs. As an investment advisor representative, you need to know why we use these tools, what they actually cost in hidden fees, and most importantly, who should absolutely, under no circumstances, be allowed to trade them.
Right.
Let's zoom out and look at the big picture. Let's synthesize everything we've talked about into the ultimate trade-offs.
Mm-hmm.
Let's start with the upside, the benefits. Why are derivatives so incredibly powerful that they make up a multi-quadrillion dollar global market? The first massive benefit is leverage.
Leverage is the ability to control a massive, substantial financial position with a very tiny initial capital investment. As we saw clearly with options, you only pay a small premium to control 100 entire shares of a high-priced stock.
Like with a TV rain check.
Yeah. With futures, you only post a relatively small good-faith margin deposit to command the economic value of thousands of barrels of oil or a massive chunk of a stock index.
The functional result of leverage is magnification. It acts like a magnifying glass on returns. A tiny 1% price change in the underlying asset can result in a massive 50 or 100 or even 200% return on your initial margin or premium investment. It is financial steroids. It allows for incredible capital efficiency. What is the second major benefit?
Hedging. The ability to surgically transfer specific risks. We saw this with cautious Chloe, buying protective puts to ensure her concentrated tech portfolio against a crash, and Farmer Fred selling futures to lock in his crop prices and ensure his business survival.
So it's basically insurance.
Derivatives are the ultimate risk management tools for individuals and corporations who demand certainty in an uncertain world.
And the third major benefit is flexibility. If you just buy normal stock, you only have one path to profitability.
Mm-hmm.
You have to sit there and pray the price goes up, the market crashes, you lose. Derivatives break that constraint. They allow you to profit in absolutely any market environment.
Precisely. The multi-directional nature of derivatives is unparalleled. If you are bullish, you can buy calls, sell puts, or buy futures. If you are bearish and think the market is going to crash, you don't just have to sit in cash. You can actively profit by buying puts, selling calls, or shorting futures.
You can even structure complex multi-leg option strategies like straddles or iron condors to extract a profit if the market just trades completely flat and goes absolutely nowhere.
It's an incredibly versatile toolkit.
But of course, nothing in finance is free. There are costs associated with this incredible flexibility. I'll list these direct costs quickly because they are straightforward, but they will show up as variables in exam questions. First, there are option premiums, the actual upfront cash cost to buy the contract. Then there are broker commissions, the transaction fees you pay your brokerage firm every time you enter or exit a trade.
And we cannot forget bid-ask spreads. This is the hidden structural cost on every single trade you make. It is the mathematical difference between what a buyer is willing to pay the bid and what a seller is willing to accept they ask.
Every time you cross that spread to execute a market order, you are paying a tiny invisible toll to the institutional market makers who provide liquidity.
In highly liquid markets like S&P futures, the spread is tiny. In illiquid markets like specific forward contracts or deep out-of-the-money options, the spread can be massive and eat your entire profit.
And finally, a nuanced cost. Margin interest. Now, careful here, listener. We just established, forcefully, that futures margin is a good faith deposit, not a loan. So why on earth would we list margin interest as a potential cost of doing business?
Good catch. While the futures margin itself is absolutely not a loan from the broker, the reality of corporate finance is that if a massive trader or an agricultural firm has to borrow money from a commercial bank just to come up with the millions of dollars in cash required to post that good faith deposit at the exchange, they will obviously have to pay interest on that commercial bank loan.
So it's an indirect cost.
Yes. It is an indirect but very real cost of doing business in the derivatives market.
All right. We've covered the shiny benefits and the direct costs. Now we need to descend into the dark side. We need to talk about the inherent risks and the conceptual exam traps. Because the brutal reality of derivatives is that the exact things that make them so powerful and appealing are the exact same things that make them incredibly dangerous. Let's go right back to leverage.
This is a massive conceptual gotcha for the exam. Leverage is a double-edged sword. On the Series 66, leverage will be listed as both a primary benefit and a primary risk, depending entirely on the context of the question. Yes, leverage magnificently amplifies your gains when you are right, but it equally and ruthlessly amplifies your losses when you are wrong.
And we need to be very specific about how those leverage losses actually work mathematically. If I buy a normal unleveraged share of stock for $1,000, the absolute worst thing that can happen in the real world is that the company goes bankrupt, the stock goes to zero, and I lose my $1,000. My maximum potential loss is strictly capped at my initial investment. I can't lose more than I put in.
But when you introduce the leverage of derivatives, specifically in the futures market, and in short, uncovered options, your losses can vastly exceed your initial investment.
Let me repeat that, because it violates normal common sense, and it is vital for the exam. In derivatives, losses can exceed your initial investment. Remember our buddy Reckless Ricky? He collected a tiny $200 premium for his short call. That was his only initial transaction. He didn't put up any other money.
And he lost everything.
Yet he ended up losing nearly $49,000. He lost way, way, way more than he started with. With futures contracts, a small, sudden adverse move in the market overnight can blow right through your $10,000 margin deposit and leave you legally owing the brokerage firm tens of thousands of dollars in unsecured debt.
The exam will test this fundamental distinction between asset classes. Buying stocks, buying bonds, buying options, your risk of loss is strictly limited to what you paid. Shorting naked options or trading highly leveraged futures contracts your risk of loss can infinitely exceed your initial cash deposit.
Okay, here's another entirely unique risk. It doesn't apply to stocks, it doesn't apply to bonds, and it doesn't apply to futures. It only applies to options, and it involves a ticking clock. It is called time decay, or theta.
Options are what financial professionals refer to as wasting assets. The best way to visualize this is to imagine buying a beautiful, perfectly square ice cube and setting it on the hot concrete sidewalk on a sunny July afternoon.
Oh man.
The longer that ice cube sits there, the smaller it gets. It is constantly losing mass until eventually it is just a microscopic puddle of water that evaporates into nothing. Options work the exact same way.
Explain the math behind the melting ice cube.
An option premium is made up of two distinct parts: intrinsic value and time value. Intrinsic value is the actual built-in profit if you exercise the option right this second. Time value is the extra premium people are willing to pay just for the hope that the stock will move favorably before the expiration date.
But that hope has an expiration date.
As that expiration date approaches, that hope dwindles. Every single day that passes, the time value of the option literally melts away. And mathematically, this decay process isn't linear. It actually accelerates incredibly rapidly in the final 30 days before expiration. The ice cube melts faster and faster.
Okay, listener, direct question time again. Think deeply about the mechanics we discussed. Think about our characters. If an option's value rots away and melts like an ice cube purely because time is passing, who is financially hurt by that? The buyer holding the contract or the seller who wrote it? I'll let you think for a second. It inherently hurts the buyer.
Exactly. Time decay is the relentless enemy of cautious Chloe. If she buys a call option hoping a stock goes up, she doesn't just need the stock to move up. She needs it to move up fast enough and far enough to overcome both the strike price and the mathematical reality that her contract is losing time value every single day simply because the clock is ticking. She is fighting an uphill battle against time.
But on the flip side of that equation, who absolutely loves time decay? Reckless Ricky. Time decay is the best friend of the option seller.
They love it.
Ricky sells an option, collects the premium up front, and then he just sits back, crosses his arms, and watches the ice cube melt. Every single day that passes without the underlying stock making a massive move against him, that contract becomes slightly less valuable to the buyer. Which means Ricky is one day closer to the contract expiring worthless, allowing him to keep his premium free and clear. Time is on his side.
The exam frequently tests this specific dynamic. Time decay, or theta, negatively impacts option buyers and actively benefits option sellers.
We also briefly touched on liquidity risk and counterparty risk. Just remember to associate those heavily with OTC forward contracts. You can get trapped in a position because there is no centralized exchange to trade with, or the other guy might just go bankrupt, breach the contract, and leave you holding the bag.
Which brings us to the final and arguably most important professional responsibility you will have regarding derivatives: suitability. This is where the rubber meets the road.
Yeah, this is huge.
The Series 66 is a regulatory exam. They test heavily on your ethical, legal, and professional obligations as a fiduciary investment advisor representative. You must know who these tools are actually for.
Let's lay down the regulatory law. Expert, based on FINRA and NASA guidelines, who should be utilizing derivatives in their portfolios?
They are highly appropriate for clients who have a specific, identifiable need to hedge an existing concentrated position. Cautious Chloe protecting her massive tech stock portfolio with a put option is a textbook suitable recommendation.
Okay, that's one.
They are appropriate for clients looking to generate incremental income on existing stable holdings like Ricky, writing covered calls on his blue chip utility stock. They are entirely appropriate for institutional or corporate clients managing complex portfolio risk or locking in business supply chain prices like Farmer Fred.
But there's a catch, right?
But crucially, even in these scenarios, derivatives are only appropriate for sophisticated investors who fundamentally understand the complex mathematics, the time decay, and the mechanics of what they are actually trading.
And more importantly for the exam, who are these tools wildly legally inappropriate for?
They are completely unsuitable for unsophisticated retail investors who do not understand the mechanics and are just trying to aggressively speculate with money they cannot afford to lose. They are flagrantly inappropriate for risk-averse investors who prioritize capital preservation. You absolutely do not put a 75-year-old grandmother's fixed-income retirement fund into leveraged S&P 500 futures contracts.
Definitely not.
And they are completely forbidden from a suitability standpoint for anyone who does not fundamentally understand the concept of leverage and the terrifying reality that they could lose vastly more than their initial investment.
So as a licensed advisor, if a novice client comes into your office and says, hey, I just read a thread on an internet forum that said I can get rich overnight by selling naked call options on a bankrupt video game company, your regulatory job is not to execute that trade.
Absolutely not.
Your job is to politely, clearly, but firmly explain exactly why that is financial suicide and to heavily document in their client file that you advised against it based on their risk profile.
Exactly. The Series 66 exam tests derivatives at a conceptual and suitability level. They are not going to ask you to calculate the complex Greek variables like the gamma or the vega of a multi-leg asymmetrical iron condor spread.
Thank goodness.
They want to know, do you understand what these instruments are? Do you know what the hidden costs are? Do you truly grasp the mathematical risks? And do you know who should and shouldn't use them?
Wow, okay. We have covered a truly massive amount of ground in this deep dive. We have comprehensively traversed the asymmetrical landscape of choice and obligation in the options market. We've met Cautious Chloe, we've watched Reckless Ricky blow up his account, and we've helped Farmer Fred secure his harvest.
We covered it all.
We've seen handshakes turn into ironclad handcuffs in the daily settled futures market, and we've walked down the dark, unregulated alleys of the OTC forward market. Let's lock this firmly into your working memory right now before test day. It is time for the rapid-fire recap. Top testable takeaways. Let's go. Takeaway number one, options power dynamics. Remember the remote control. Buyers pay premiums to acquire the right, and their risk is strictly limited to that premium. Sellers collect premiums, assume the absolute obligation to perform, and take on massive, potentially unlimited risk, especially when writing naked calls.
Takeaway number two, covered calls. This is the most conservative, frequently tested option strategy. They are used to generate synthetic income on a stagnant portfolio, but they absolutely require the seller to already own the underlying stock. The word covered literally means you own the shares to protect against upside risk. Takeaway number three, futures contracts, handcuffs. They legally obligate both the buyer and the seller to perform. They settle daily through mark-to-market accounting, which actively prevents hidden, unmanageable losses from accumulating. And most importantly, futures margin is a good faith performance deposit, absolutely not a loan.
Takeaway number four, forward contracts, the Wild West. They are custom, privately negotiated, over-the-counter agreements. They only settle at expiration. And because there is no central clearinghouse to guarantee the trade, they carry an incredibly high degree of counterparty risk.
And takeaway number five, the trade-offs. Leverage is a double-edged sword that magnifies both your gains and your losses, sometimes resulting in losses exceeding your initial investment. And time decay, the melting ice cube, relentlessly hurts option buyers while actively helping option sellers.
Brilliant summary. Now, before we sign off and let you get back to your practice exams, I want to leave you with a final, slightly provocative thought to mull over while you're walking the dog, doing the dishes, or driving to work.
Okay, let's hear it.
We spent a lot of time today talking about how these tools are used responsibly to protect individuals and corporations against bad things happening. Chloe protecting her tech stock, Fred locking in his wheat prices. Derivatives act as vital insurance policies for the global financial system.
They absolutely do. But I want you to step back and think about the broader macroeconomic picture. Think about the massive, systematically important global banks and multinational corporations. They aren't just trading standardized futures on the CME.
Oh, definitely not.
They are heavily, heavily utilizing the Wild West. They're silently passing massive, multi-billion dollar risks to one another through highly complex, completely unregulated OTC forward contracts and bespoke swaps.
It is a massive, invisible web of handshake deals spanning the entire globe, hidden in the dark corners of balance sheets. Every single major bank is relying on another major bank to fulfill their end of the bargain. So the ultimate question is, what happens to the entire global financial system if just one major player, one massive, deeply interconnected counterparty, suddenly files for bankruptcy and fails to keep their handshake deal?
All of those hedges fail at once. The dominoes are all lined up in the dark.
It makes you look at the abstract concept of counterparty risk in a whole new, terrifyingly real light.
A very sobering thought to end the study session on. It is exactly the dynamic that fueled the 2008 financial crisis.
Exactly. The real-world consequences of these textbook definitions are massive. But for now, your only job is to conquer the Series 66. You now have the characters, the analogies, the deep mathematical understanding, and the clear distinction between the what and the why to absolutely crush the derivative section of this exam. Trust the knowledge you've built, watch out for those carefully worded exam traps, and keep pushing forward. We'll see you next time on The Deep Dive.